Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
And a very good morning to you. I'm Lynette, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon this morning. And Dr. Mixon, it's just you and I today.
Tis indeed, but that's enough.
That's
what do we need the rest of them for?
There we go. Yes, we have lots we can talk about and dig into. And you'll answer all the questions. I'll just welcome our guests.
All right, let's do that.
Why don't I go ahead and give our phone number out? We are live in the studio. Dr. Jerry Mixon is here. And this is the number 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. All right, so there you go. If you've got a question about your health or aging or whatever it is that ails you, we would love to talk with you. We've had so many different cases called in over the last few weeks, lots of different things. And last week we had Dr. Payne, our pain doctor,
that's right,
our pain specialist, Dr. Dan Nelson. So here we go. Dr. Mixon, what would you like to talk about? Is there anything making news headlines right now?
Oh, a fair bit making news headlines. Again, we've got a bat carried virus.
Oh, boy.
The Marburg virus, which is in Rwanda. Probably not going to hit us here. This is a virus that is spread primarily by body fluids, sweat, vomit, stool, semen. So, you know, someone's carrying the virus and you are sharing bed sheets with them and so on, you can contract the virus.
Okay.
You know, or you're having intercourse with them, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Very low risk of it spreading internationally, since hygiene standards tend to be somewhat better through most of Europe, Asia, and the U.S. than in rural Rwanda.
Okay.
So, had an interesting situation, exchange of emails the last few days. Hmm. So, you know, excuse me, I'm a little bit hoarse for some reason this morning. We've known for a couple of years now that senescent cell therapies in animals reverse the mousy equivalent of Alzheimer's disease. Mm. We have rodents that are actually genetically bred to get dementia. And it's a dementia that is very similar to the human version of Alzheimer's disease. And we know that if we treat the senescent cells in these animals, their cognition improves. So there has been some very significant interest in trying the dasatinib quercetin that we currently use for our senescent cell therapies in human dementia. And there's been a couple of very small early studies that have been published, most of them published last year. There's then larger ones that are underway right now that I'm waiting to see them published. But in the early studies, it looks like senescent cell therapy decreases the tau tangles and the amyloid beta in the brain and improves cognition.
Okay.
That's going to be kind of exciting.
Yes, that's good news.
If the largest studies show it. The reason this came up is we have a patient that came to us with early stage Alzheimer's disease several years ago. And this patient has been on the Bredesen program, as well as the things that we can do for her. And her symptoms have not been progressing the way you would expect with Alzheimer's disease. They did not get better, but they've just kind of stabilized, which is really kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. She was scheduled to have some testing to see if she could go on a new drug protocol over at the University of Washington. But while waiting, she went ahead and had one of my doctors treat her with the dasatinib quercetin, the senescent cell therapy. And she is reporting that clinically, she is feeling better, sharper, getting better memory, not having word loss and so on like she did before. She then went over to the UW and they tested her, but were not able to find any of the tau protein in her brain. In her blood sample. So she's doing too well to get in the study to see if this new medication will help or not, which I thought was really pretty fascinating.
Yes.
You know, we're 9 days of therapy, 3 days each week for 3 weeks, in addition to the exercise, the hormone balancing, the Bredesen supplements. She's not getting worse. In fact, her subjective evaluation is she actually thinks she's getting better.
Wow.
I thought that was really neat.
Now, that is very encouraging.
That's one person.
Okay.
That is not a study.
Yes.
But obviously she and her husband take it, you know, with great gratitude. So the doc was asking if I'd be willing to chat with a neurologist over at UW, and of course I will. In fact, earlier today, I reviewed her chart and went back over her studies and so on. And so, yeah, I think I'll be giving the UW a call on Monday or Tuesday and chatting with her neurologist about it.
Very good. Wow. And this was her first time with the senescent cell therapy?
Yes.
Wow. And just the beginning stages of Alzheimer's.
Early stage.
It
has stayed at early stage for years. That's
okay.
The point. Normally, Alzheimer's, once it's there, it's progressive. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And the things that have been doing for her and with her, it's been kind of stalled. And now with the dasatinib and quercetin, she actually, subjectively at least, is reporting that she thinks she's doing better.
We like to hear that.
Yeah.
That's good. Some good news.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of hopeful. I think one patient is far too small to be truly encouraged, but hopeful.
That is true. Very good.
All right.
All right. You want to take a phone call, Dr. Mixon?
Why not?
All right. Here is the number to get through, just like some early folks did. We don't want to make them wait too long. Here is the number, 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. First, we have Kay from Seattle calling in. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hello, Kay.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I'm wondering, I had my tubes tied when I was younger, and I'm wondering what kind of health effects it has as you age. Does it adversely restrict your hormones, and does it increase your risk of ovarian cancer?
Good questions. It depends in part on the techniques used to ligate your tubes. The more trauma done to the tubes, the more trauma done to the blood supply to the ovaries. And if the blood supply to the ovaries is decreased or impinged to some degree, then we get hormonal declines because the ovaries simply are not working as well as they should. So if they use something like the clips that just ligate the tube itself, and they didn't use electric cautery or anything, then more than likely it'll have no impact at all. If they use the electric cautery to kind of cook the tubes, there is a higher chance that that would damage the arterial supply to the ovaries and could increase the damage to those ovaries and decrease the amount of hormone production and so on. So...
Is there any...
My answer has to be a very firm maybe.
Mm.
on hormones or on cancer risk?
Hormone risk.
Hormones.
Which is related to cancer risk to some modest degree. For instance, we know that women with higher testosterone load have a lower incidence of breast cancer. They have less dementia. They have less osteoporosis. So if your ovaries are still producing significant amounts of testosterone, you do well. Estrogen, more related to hot flashes, mood swings, and so on. But also, if your estrogen level stayed in a good spot, you'd be more likely to have a modest reduction in your risk of breast cancer.
So am I understanding you saying that it depends on the woman as to whether or not it affected the hormones? Or
yes.
Does it always, because you've tied off the tubes?
Well, it's not the ligation of the tubes. It's the damage to the ovaries that can occur incidental to the ligation of the tubes. And see, there's a lot of different ways to tie a lady's tubes. You can simply put a stitch across it in two spots. You can take a stitch across it in two spots and then cut out the little segment in between. You can put an electric cautery on it and basically coagulate or fry the tubes. There are some little metal and plastic clips you can slide across the tube and simply pinch them closed. So how those tubes were tied, the surgical technique, and the enthusiasm and aggression of the doctor doing the procedure can impact how well those ovaries function for the rest of her life.
Okay, and that has very little effect. Well, if it's the minor surgery, it has very little effect on cancer in the ovaries.
It should have virtually no impact.
Gotcha. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you for the call, Kay.
Sure. In a slightly related, in men who believe they are women and are treated with high-dose estrogens, we are seeing a significant increase in the risk of thyroid cancer in those.
Wow.
Yes, those men who consider themselves transgender women.
Okay.
So apparently we males are not designed to have really high estrogen loads.
And there you go.
Doing bad things to the thyroid.
Okay. We're talking about your health, your aging, and whatever you would like to discuss on Leading Edge Medicine today. My name is Lynette. I'm here with Dr. Jerry Mixon, and we will be back with Ron and Glenn in just a moment. Stay right there. Along with Dr. Mixon today, Dr. Jerry Mixon here, answering your questions. Get in that phone queue by calling 1-206-421-5757. Okay, we're going to Tukwila. Ron is on the line with a question for you, doctor.
Hello, Ron. How do we help?
Hi, Jerry. I'm a longevity patient. I'm 80 years old. I consider myself to be extremely fit and healthy. I do carry the BRCA2 gene, and I've had a number of relatives die prematurely, so I pay close attention to potential cancer. A year ago, I had the Galleri test in your office. Got a call back, hey, everything's okay, no cancer signal whatsoever. 2 weeks ago, I did the Galleri test again, and I got the report that there's a very strong signal for pancreatic and a bile duct cancer, and a mild signal for stomach and esophageal cancer. I'm on it, and I've got an MRI scheduled, hopefully next week. Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we got cut off. So I got an MRI scheduled for next week, and I want to get an EUS, the endoscopy ultrasound. Right. And so anyway, that's the way I'm forging ahead. And boy, I tell you, you got to be a magician to get these appointments, and you got to bend these people over and practically camp on their doorstep. But I'm working on it. So what are your suggestions here at this stage of the game?
It sounds like you're doing all the right things. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a screening test. It's not 100%
right.
accurate, but it is about 99%+ accurate.
Yes. So glad you did it again after doing it last
year. That's what I don't like, 99.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, there are rare, very rare false positive signals, and, you know, it happens, but it is, you know, one patient in 1,000 or thereabouts. So when you get a positive signal, you really need to jump on it and do the confirmatory tests, which is exactly what you're doing. You're getting the gastroenterologists involved, and, you know, they're doing the ultrasounds and the MRIs and going down with the scopes and seeing what they can find.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the good news is that, you know, this will often pick up the DNA from the tumor long before you have any symptoms, and that gives us the best chance to get it cured before it has spread.
Yeah, I have zero symptoms, so that I feel really good about, and I've done a lot of research. They say if you catch it at stage one, the Whipple procedure gives you an 88% chance of making it 5 years. If you're stage two, it's about 44% chance of making it 5 years. I can get along with either one of those.
Yes, but even the 44%, the side effects of the therapy are far more profound if you're having to get pounded with chemo and so on during that 5 years. So
we'd like
to catch this as early as possible, intervene as early as possible, with minimal impact on the rest of your health and your life's quality. On the one hand, I'm sorry that it came up positive. On the other hand, I'm delighted that they appear to have found this long before you have any symptoms or pain.
Yes.
Because that gives you your best chance of survival.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, I'll tell you, that gallery test, man, that's
$1,000
interesting.
$1,000 well spent, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know what's interesting? Of course, now I'm YouTubing and Googling this stuff like crazy. I heard a YouTube survivor story, and it was very interesting because he had the gallery test. He got the exact same result as I did, a very high signal for pancreatic and bile duct cancer and a mild signal for stomach and esophageal cancer. And I thought, well, that's sort of interesting. Is this some kind of a boilerplate thing they send out if they get a signal, or is it really specific to me?
Yeah, no, it is specific, but what happens is these things often occur in a specific pattern. You know, biliary cancers, that whole biliary tree, we're looking at the stomach, the bile ducts, the pancreatic ducts, and the pancreas itself, are all tightly interconnected right there in the duodenum. And so if you get a cancer in that area, right in that complex, you will often get irritation and inflammation and early spread in all of those areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hey, appreciate your guys' service, and I'll keep you posted, maybe.
Yes, and let's keep you a patient, not for 5 years, but let's have you with us for another 25 years, shall we?
Yes. Very good. Thank you for that, Ron.
Yep.
You know, I think that's why it's important. You know, we have done the gallery test, I believe, 3 times this year.
Yes.
And if you've done it once, like a year or so ago, just like Ron did, don't think one and done. I'm good. I'm so glad that he came back again, and especially with the BRCA2 that he is.
Yes. Well, the BRCA2 means genetically he is predisposed to pancreatic cancers and very nasty prostate cancers too, just as the women with this are exposed to pancreatic, ovarian, and breast cancers, you know, like about a 99% chance in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a BRCA 1 or 2, male or female, this is a test you should be getting on an annual basis. In fact, it's about time for me to do it for my second time.
Okay.
Because I'm 77 years old. My father had prostate cancer. And my mother had both breast and colon cancer. And so with cancers in both of my parents, this is a test that I do periodically, just because if I develop any of those, I want to find them as early as possible, and I want to give me my best chance of getting rid of them.
All right, and that's the Galleri test that we're talking about. We've done that here at Longevity a few times, and I'm sure we'll schedule it again.
Well, our patients can get it anytime they want.
Yes, that's right.
All our patients have to do is tell their doctor, I want a Galleri, and we do it for them. Now, we periodically, a couple of times a year, we will set aside a Saturday where we let people that are not patients come in and get the test. But you know, we just don't have the staffing and stuff to give it to everybody in the state of Washington whenever they want it. So on demand is limited to our patients. On our special fairs is when we open it up to other people.
Okay. Now, Dr. Mixon, he had mentioned the BRCA 2, and then you also mentioned BRCA 1.
Yeah.
What type of a test is this? I think we're hearing more about this, because this is something that I think Angelina Jolie kind of made it popular.
Yes.
And brought awareness to it, because she had both.
One and two.
Yeah, one and two. Yeah, so she chose to have the mass.
If you have positive BRCA, it's a genetic mutation.
Okay.
That puts you at very high risk of specific cancers. And we first found this in women, probably 30 years ago.
Mm.
And that a woman who is positive has a 99% chance of getting breast cancer during her lifetime, which means, you know, these are girls often will develop cancer in their 20s. I mean, normally we don't see breast cancer before about 40, 45, 50. As the hormone levels are dropping, the breast cancer starts rising. You know, girls in their 30s usually have enough hormones to protect them against breast cancer, but not if they're BRCA positive, either one or two. These are two different genes, but they're closely related, and they're both very high risk for these cancers. And then it was only about 10 years ago we started finding, oh, wait a minute, why would only women have this?
Mm.
Why not men too? And so we actually now in our practice have a couple of men with positive high-grade malignancies in their prostates that are BRCA positive.
Okay. All right. Now, if someone listening today is like, wow, I think I need to get checked for that. I, too, have parents on both sides that have cancer. Is that something that they we don't do the testing for that here at Longevity. Is that correct?
No, we don't.
We don't.
Although
okay.
we can send it out. I mean, it's a simple, it's a blood test. We just do a genetic screen. And any doctor can order it. Your family doctor can check it. Your internist, your gynecologist, your proctologist. If he's got a doctorate degree in medicine, he can
check it.
He can order it.
Okay. So that's good to know. I wonder if insurance covers that. Do you know that, Dr. Mixon?
They generally do.
They generally do. So that's for the BRCA gene that we have talked about a little bit.
Yeah.
But if you're interested in that, check with your doctor. All right. We are going to take a quick break here on Leading Edge Medicine, and we will be back with Glenn and Susan and Bill in just a moment. If you have a question for Dr. Jerry Mixon, he's here in the studio today, 206-421-5757. The number to get through today is 206-421-5757. We'll be right back.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started in to hum. Still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
All right, the best is yet to come. Welcome back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. I'm Lynette, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon, and we are here to answer your questions and talk to you about what is bothering you, your health, your symptoms, and maybe a diagnosis recently. We are headed over to Tenino. Glenn has a question for you, Dr. Mixon. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, Glenn.
Good morning. I've taken proteined up pretty good last night before I went to bed, and I woke up at my normal time, and I got to tell you, I was sleeping so freaking hard that it actually crossed my mind. I understand why some people die when they're sleeping, which is always one of my wishes. I've said for years, if I die, I want to die in bed with a cute little neighbor girl. But fortunately, I've been lucky. There's really not been any good-looking neighbor girls in my neighborhood, so I'm safe for a while.
Okay, well, that's good. Especially if you have a wife who would
that's true would not
kill,
like
would
that.
Kill you if she found you there. So mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I'm still waiting for that one. Maybe my next lifetime. It's looking kind of bleak. But I wanted to call up and ask you: is there what's the best way to sleep? I prefer to sleep on my left side. And when I woke up, I had mild symptoms of having a heart attack. Uh-huh. And it's like, wow, should I be sleeping in a different position? I mean, as deep as I slept, you know, am I doing myself a disservice by sleeping on my left-hand side?
No.
No?
Not generally. I mean, if you can have some orthopedic and some neurologic problems that maybe would complicate it, but I don't hear anything in what you've told me so far that would limit your sleeping position. You know, it's just a matter of where you are most comfortable.
I get my deepest sleep when I sleep on my left-hand side. I can sleep on my right-hand side, but I don't really go into that total ozone world, you know.
Okay. Well, I'm all for zoning out and sleeping as deeply as possible. Now, personally, I sleep on my left side most of the time, my right side some of the time. I never get much sleep on my back because then I tend to snore and I end up with my wife's foot right in the middle of my ribs, you know, saying, wake up and shut up. So that's why I tend to sleep on my sides.
Okay. protecting your chest.
That's right. I don't like to get kicked when I'm deep in sleep. But that is an effective way to stop me from snoring.
That's true. It does work. I've tried it on my husband.
All right. Well, thank you. I was wondering if I could maybe sleep better to, not wake up.
Whatever you need to do to sleep soundly and deeply and wake up rested and refreshed and ready for the day, that's the position I want you in.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you. Have a good weekend.
All right. Take care.
Oh, thank you for the call, Glenn. I remember when I had my babies many years ago. With the first baby, they said make them sleep on their back as babies. With baby number two, it was sleep on their stomach. Mm-hmm. Then with baby number three, it was sleep on the side. And they had a little wedge that it was like with all three, it was all different each time. So
yeah, pediatrics tends to be even more prone to fads, even among physicians,
okay,
than any other part of medicine, I think.
All right. Well, here we go. We are taking more calls for you, and you can get in the call queue as well. 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We are headed to beautiful Bellevue, not too far away. Susan is on the line. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Oh, we don't have Susan, so we'll go to Bill. And Susan, we dropped you, so why don't you call back? We'll head over to Bill in Tacoma.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
Good morning. How can I help you, sir?
I have three questions I'd like to know if you'd be willing to answer for me. Two of them are regarding Parkinson's, and the third one is regarding cancer.
All right,
the first question I have is there was a fellow on the radio.
Then, okay. Am I willing to answer your questions? Yes. Am I able to answer your questions? I don't know yet. Let's hear the questions.
Okay. There was a fellow on the radio by the name of Dr. Joel Wallach.
Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out, is he a quack or a charlatan? He's claiming he can cure Parkinson's. Do you have any comments on him?
If he is curing Parkinson's, I'd love to see his papers. Where he documents his technology and the number of patients he's cured and what he's doing, because some portions of Parkinson's disease, I know we can help. I don't know anybody that truly cures it. But, you know, there are some of the guys over in Seattle that are using the gamma knife that are interrupting the tremor so that the hands are not shaking so much. There are some things we can do to improve balance and fatigue, such as testosterone. But I'm not aware of anybody that is curing Parkinson's per se.
Okay. And my second question is, I understand there's some success with curing Parkinson's with electric shock.
I don't know. The only studies I've seen, and they are very experimental with Parkinson's, that are claiming significant improvement that comes anywhere near close to being a cure is some of the modified stem cells that are actually being implanted in the brain at the substantia nigra to help those neurons recover. And that is not a therapy that is available, and how well it's going to work in the long run is still really out. But there are some studies, both on animals and some very early human studies being done with amplified stem cells that might, at some point in the future, result in a cure. But I don't think it's there yet.
I'd like to have your comment on President Carter. I understand that he survived brain cancer and liver cancer and lymphoid cancer.
Wow.
And it was all done with the experimental process.
And he just celebrated 100 years.
100 years.
This week.
Right. Yeah. Yep. And although he's been on, we've expected him to die for quite some time, but he just hasn't done it. And he had a malignant melanoma that had already spread. So he doesn't appear to have had primary cancers, but the malignant melanoma had spread to multiple sites. And he was on some very aggressive experimental immunotherapies in which his own immune system is being sensitized to the tumors and the tumors sensitized to his immune system so that he would be able to more effectively fight these tumors. And so far, it seems to be working okay for him. He's still around.
He's still here, yes.
So,
very good. Thank you for your comments, and thank you for your program.
You're welcome, sir. Take care.
Thank you for that, Bill. All right, we are going to go to break here in just a moment, but I believe that that Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, is the only president that has reached the age of 100.
Yes, he's the only centurion president we've had.
Wow. Wow. Okay. All right, you hear the music. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back with Alan, who has a question. And we lost you, Susan. Feel free to call us back. Here's that number to get through today on our phones and get into the phone queue. It's 206-421-5757. That is 206-421-5757. We're taking a quick break. Then we'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine. Number to get through, like so many have this morning already, 206-421-5757. Dr. Mixon,
yes.
Dr. Umat is gone, and she is far, far away right now, right?
Far, far. She's in India right now.
All right.
Apparently, she has two nieces getting married in India. So
wonderful.
Yeah, so she had to take off, I think it was Wednesday night, and zip over, and then had one wedding right away while she's still thoroughly jet lagged, and then one next week. And then, so she's going to miss two weekends.
Okay.
But she shall return.
All right.
And then it'll be my turn to go away.
That's right. Okay. But for today, Dr. Mixon is here taking the calls. So we are going to head to Kirkland, and we have Alan on the line. Welcome to the show, Alan. This is Leading Edge Medicine.
Hello, Alan. How can I help?
Yes. I am a patient of your clinic, and I'm taking a testosterone cream, applying it to the inner thighs, And I was given instructions at one time, a minimum of 6 hours and a maximum of 12. And right. I'm old enough that I end up falling asleep. So I was going to take it off last night, and next thing I know, it's like past 1 o'clock or something. So what's the what's that time have to do anything with it to,
Okay. Well, for how old are you?
79.
79. Okay, so you're 2 years older than me.
Okay.
Right, let me tell you how I do it, the advantages and the disadvantages of doing it the way I do it, and then you can come up with your own method, all right?
Okay.
The reason that we have you wash it off periodically is two things. A, if you are sleeping with a woman, you don't want to get too much of it on her because you'll kick her levels up higher than we want them to be. Especially if you're having intercourse with her and you're getting that skin-to-skin contact. She may absorb a lot. So what I do with mine is I put mine on every morning. I shave, and then I put on my progesterone and my testosterone, take my morning vitamins, go do my exercise, go get breakfast, hit the trail, and then come to work. I wash it off every evening when I'm settling down for the evening, usually around 8 o'clock or so at night. So mine goes on at 5:30 in the morning and goes off at 8 at night. So mine is on about 15 hours a day, right?
Okay.
And I just find that to be easy. I don't have to think about it much. I put it on in the morning and wash it off before I go to bed at night because I'm going to snuggle down with my wife and I don't want to have it all over my body, and certainly, you know, not if we're going to have intercourse. Because I like to keep, I use it not just on my thighs, I put it on my genitals. And so if it's on my genitalia and we're having intercourse, then, you know, she'll get a really high dose of it because the vagina absorbs testosterone and estrogen about six times more efficiently than skin does. So it's mucous membrane. And it's very sensitive to these sex hormones. So for me, it's just a matter of simplicity. Put it on in the morning, wash it off at night. Now, because I'm leaving it on a long time, about every couple of years, about every 2 years, I'll notice that my testicles are starting to shrink. They're getting smaller and softer. And so then I have Dr. UMAT or one of the docs here write me a prescription for some human chorionic gonadotropin. And I take an injection 2 to 3 times a week for several weeks, and then they grow back to full size and function, and I'm perfectly happy. Now, when we older men, having smaller, softer testicles is not a medical emergency. It's not a big problem. Okay. In fact, most urologists just assume that when they put men on testosterone, they're going to get testicular atrophy.
Oh, okay.
We treat it mostly for psychological reasons. Most men were born with a pair. They want to die with a pair. They don't want them to shrivel up and go away in the meantime. So every couple of years, I get treated to make sure that they are stays, you know, full size and robust.
Can I tack on one little extra onto this conversation?
Sure.
I also have just been recently diagnosed, and I'll destroy this the verbiage, but Scarsomona cell carcinoma, a skin cell. They say it's not too aggressive, but I'm going to have to do some treatment on that. Do you have any idea on what testosterone might do or not do?
It won't impact it either way.
Okay.
These little skin cancers are totally divorced from the effect of testosterone.
Okay. Just thought I would ask.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. That helps?
Yeah. Nope. Hopefully it helps. You know, just as an aside, I had a little basal cell carcinoma on my right arm, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months ago. And it just comes from sun damage. You know, when we were kids, we thought sunshine was healthy.
Yes, always out there.
No, I still remember my mother telling me, Jerry, put down that book. Get out some good, healthy sunshine. You know, and she'd chase me out of the house, and I'd leave my books behind, and I'd go out and roller skate up and down the with those steel roller skates you strap to your shoes.
Oh, with a key.
With even. A key, yes. had a key to lock them on. And then, of course, as a young man, I spent a lot of time in Vietnam and Southeast Asia in tropical sunshine with my arms and so on exposed with no sunscreen whatsoever. And so, yeah, I got a lot of sun exposure. And so, yes, that's where those skin cancers come from. And so every once in a while, I go in and the dermatologist looks me over and says, oops, let's biopsy this. Oh, now that one looks okay. You know, so it just happens. It's part of getting older and part of our youth in the sunshine.
There you go. All right. Now, part of, I'm going to re-ask part of Alan's question that he had. Now, would there be some, if you don't wash the testosterone off?
If you don't wash it off, you get two things happen.
Okay.
First of all, when you put it on again the next day, you get even higher blood levels.
Ah, okay.
It doesn't disappear. As long as that cream is on there, you're still absorbing some. You get peak absorption in about 2 hours, but even 10, 12, 15, 24 hours, if there's still some cream there, you're still getting some absorption. And so piling new cream on the next day and then more the day after that, more the day after that, you're going to end up with levels that are way too high.
Okay.
So I think it should be washed off every day.
Okay.
Start fresh. So that we have a good control of what your blood levels are.
And for men, the best places to apply that testosterone cream?
It depends on...
Why?
A lot of variables.
Okay.
The thicker the skin, the less you absorb. Some skin is very thin with a very rich blood supply, and that skin absorbs the sex hormones very efficiently. And that's why genitalia and the penis are designed to be high testosterone tissues. Their skin is real thin. There's a real rich blood supply. You get very good absorption. Inner thighs, the axilla in the armpits, in the curve of the inside of the elbow, behind the knees. These are nice thin skin with decent blood supply, and you get good absorption there. The thicker the skin, the less absorption. So, you know, shoulders and back, which has very thick, poorly vascularized skin, you're not going to absorb much.
Okay.
So it depends on, A, how much of the testosterone is in the cream, how much of the cream you apply, how much skin you applied it to, because you put it to a large surface area, you get more absorption, how thin the skin is, and how vascular the skin is. So you got a lot of variables involved.
Okay.
And so what we end up doing is working with each individual and say, okay, whatever you're doing is a little too much. Let's either cut down the amount or cut down the amount of surface area or change positions. Or we tell the next guy, you know what? You're not absorbing enough. You either need to use more cream or we put more testosterone in or you apply it to a bigger surface area. And all of these things, that's why the doctor has to work with each individual.
Okay. And measure.
And we measure their blood levels over and over and over till we get it right.
Very good. And now what about women with their testosterone cream? Where is the
same
best
sort
place?
Of thing.
Okay.
Well, again, behind the knees is a common place.
Mm-hmm.
Especially our younger cohort or women that are playing with the grandchildren a lot. Okay. So behind the knees, in the axilla, in the armpits, it's another very nice place. Women that don't want to use very much can put it in the introitus, the opening to the vagina. Again, if it's on that mucous membrane, you don't need much because you absorb a whole lot there. Some women who are still and want to be sexually active, they put a little dab right on the clitoris. And that causes a little clitoral enlargement, which just means it's stimulated more easily during intercourse. And so that's a little trick that we use with some of our ladies that want to increase their sexual sensitivity.
Okay.
So we have a lot of choices to where to put it. It all depends on what you're trying to accomplish and what their blood levels are running.
Very good. And also, as with the men, the women need to wash that off each night.
We wash it off each night.
Very good. We're getting lots of information and lots of education today on Leading Edge Medicine. We are going to take a quick break and we will be back. Let me give you the phone number to call in. It's 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We'll take a quick break. Then we will be back. We're going to talk about sinus issues. Maybe you're dealing with sinus drainage. We're going to talk to Susan about that and Gene in just a moment. Stay right there as Leading Edge Medicine continues.